Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You and Betty and the Nancys and Bills and Joes and Janes will find in the study of science a richer, more rewarding life.
Hey, welcome to Inquiring Minds. I'm Indre Viscontis. This is a podcast that explores the space where science and society collide. We want to find out what's true, what's left to discover, and why it matters. I grew up wanting to be an opera singer, and then in high school, I discovered the writings of Oliver Sacks. And all of a sudden, I had two passions, opera and neuroscience. And for a very long time, I kept those two lives very separate. But in the past 10 years, there's been an explosion of interest in the intersection between art and science. And one of the pioneers leading the way in this revolution is Susan Magsalmon. She's the founder and director of the International Arts and Mind Lab, Center for Applied Neuroaesthetics at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. Yep, that actually exists. She's also the co-director of the NeuroArts Blueprint, which is this ambitious project to try to figure out exactly how neuroscience and the arts connect and how they can push each other forward. And recently, she wrote a book with another exceptional woman, Ivy Ross, who's the vice president of design for hardware product at Google, where she leads a team that has won over 225 design awards. Together, they wrote a book called Your Brain on Art: How the Arts Transform Us. Welcome to Inquiring Minds, Susan and Ivy. It's so great to have you.
Great to be here. Thank you. Thanks for having us.
So I want to start with this premise of the difference between arts and science. You know, so often we actually think of them as polar opposites, that one does not have anything to do with the other. There are often silos in the art world that reject the objectivity and reproduce, you know, kind of reductionism of science. And vice versa, that there are people in the science world who think the arts are too wishy-washy and not something ripe for scientific investigation. But Susan, I'm more familiar with your work long-term on this. So I wanted to start with you and ask you about, across your career in terms of building the Arts and Mind Lab at Johns Hopkins, you know, how have you address this tension, and does it still exist? Is it getting less prevalent? What do you think?
It's a great question. I think I'll start by saying that I'm married to a neuroscientist, and so I really think we've perfected this idea of the marriage of arts and science, and they need each other. So without question, you could talk about the yin yang, opposites attracting, but they're really two sides of the same coin. I find science and scientists to be among the most creative and curious people that I know, only maybe slightly second to artists. Artists have always intuitively understood the way the arts change us, and they have, in any art form, consistently used the arts to improve our health and well-being, to make us think about things that we maybe hadn't pushed ideas into the zeitgeist. And I think what we're seeing now through the evolutions around technology and the way science can explore things non-invasively is the why and the how the arts change us. But these are really bi-directional, co-created conversations and research. So we do a lot of work at interdisciplinary studies to be able to understand what I like to call ways of knowing and bringing together neurobiology, neuroscience, cognitive science, but also public health, the arts. And increasingly, I have been talking a lot about lifting up technology as a really important catalyst for research, for intervention, and for dissemination and scaling.
You know, I think one of the big misconceptions people have about artists, and maybe this comes from the way arts are taught in school, is that there isn't rigor. And in fact, as you kind of intimated, the professional artists that I know are even more, pay more attention to detail, are even more kind of, you know, driven to strive for perfection and accuracy, whatever that might be, in their art form, than the scientists I know. I mean, there's a real kind of iterative nature to it, a very serious way of approaching the work. And so I wonder, Ivy, as someone who, you know, came up with a design background, you know, you went to design school and you worked in the fashion industry and you are a celebrated jewelry maker. Can you speak a little bit to, you know, this misconception of the artist as a flighty, you know character and how incorrect that actually is?
Well, you know, there's been a lot of research on getting into the flow state, which I think is what you're describing. You know, when you are really engaged in the making of something, you lose a sense of time, and it's feeding your brain and body. And so I know, having started as a craftsman person, when I was deeply engaged in the making, I was connected on a whole different level, and there was no time. And it was serious and it was detailed work. But what we talk about in the book is that, you know, there's the serious artist and then there's the common man that can do art without judgment. And that is something we're really trying to get people to understand, that whether you're making art or witnessing it, beholding it, it is doing the same thing to your brain and body, and how nourishing and good it is for you. I know that I would never have to take vitamins. People say I had endless energy, and I think it was because I was walking around in this aesthetic mindset, you know, making things, paying attention to the aesthetics that were all around me. So when Susan approached me about what science was now discovering, it was, as she had said, I know that. That's like, we know that as makers. But wow, it's so amazing that now neuroscience can prove it, because the information needs to get in the hands of everyone for our own health and well-being.
And maybe I would just add to that really quickly, that the mythology and the things that society has told us are in many cases about the arts just wrong. You know, if you're not talented by third grade, you shouldn't be doing it, that you have to be good at it to have an impact. And I mean, I talk about this idea that doodlers are more analytical, they retain information better, they're more focused than non-doodlers. And it turns out that something like coloring and simple drawing can really increase, you know, executive function, which is super important when you're talking about getting organized and having sort of that conductor in your head.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely want to follow up and talk about that more specifically. But, you know, what you're talking about reminds me of, you know, Susan Rogers' recent book. We had her on the podcast back in December about, you know, how music listening aficionados are often not thought of as musicians, even though, you know, they are highly attuned to music. Or David Byrne, who in his book, How Music Works, bemoans the death of the amateur musician, how sad it is that, you know, people think that, you know, they shouldn't, if they're not, as you mentioned, really good at it, continue to play, and that they could actually reap a lot of benefits from that.
Yeah, it's really true.
Yeah, and you know, in my running even design groups and corporations, I early on 20 years ago was putting designers in sound chairs with headphones, having them listen to music 20 minutes a day with binaural beats, and to justify the cost of the sound chairs to the company, I had them take a creativity test before they started listening to music for 6 weeks, 20 minutes a day, and then after, and increase the level of creativity by 18%, which anything over 10% is significant. So I've been playing with these concepts intuitively for years now.
I wonder if we could talk a little bit about sort of these executive functioning benefits, because I think for a lot of our listeners, they might not be fully aware of what executive functioning is and why it's such a useful skill set of cognitive tools to sharpen. And in fact, you know, so I would argue that, you know, executive functioning, which, you know, sort of what the kinds of cognitive tasks that help us stay motivated, help us strategize and plan and get, you know, meet our goals. It's the kind of deliberate thinking that is largely driven by the front of the brain, the prefrontal cortex. And those are the kinds of skills that are often thought to be missing in artists, right? This idea that, like, they can't meet a deadline or they can't, you know, get their lives together. So Susan, either one of you, or maybe both of you, do you want to talk a little bit about the role of executive functioning skills in the arts? And what is this relationship between this kind of not amateur, but kind of everyday arting, doodling, what have you, and the development of these skills?
Well, I'll just say, isn't it ironic that corporations are hiring people now because they're innovative, because they have the capacity for creativity, because they can think outside of the box and are agile? And all of those are the things that schools are taking out of the curriculum. So, you know, we're talking about this end game of being highly intuitive, highly creative, and at the same time, we don't value it in our educational systems. And I think there's something really, there's a real disconnect there. You know, I guess I would start by saying that our brains are structured to build new connections and to constantly evolve. And this is from the time we're, you know, really little, really young children. And so if educational systems are set up to help us memorize and have rote memory and recall, that's not going to help us build strong synaptic neural pathways that are agile and that are expanding and are growing. So neuroplasticity, when it comes to learning, is really the name of the game. And I think executive function, as you were talking about, is a part of that prefrontal where you're learning about things like, or you're developing capacities. And I think skill around self-regulation and self-expression. And Charles Lim's work, where he looks at improvisation versus practice and being kind of the judge, the critic of yourself versus the flow state or the improvisational state, is really interesting because both of those things are actually prefrontal. Another point to make here is that in learning, we learn things better if they're salient, if they're memorable, if they're things that matter to us. And whether you're good at it or not, does it have the same balance as what's salient to you? So we know that's a really important point, is that you can love singing, you can love writing poetry, you can love this idea of, you know, being in a play or doing and not be good at it, but it's so meaningful to you that you learn it, you remember it, you recall it, you use it, which is what you want learning to be at its very, very best. And also, I think when you think about learning and environments, you have to think about neurodivergent brains. And, you know, neurodivergence is now what I consider to be a social justice issue. They're underreported, probably 40% or more of us in the world that are considered neurodivergent. So how do you create environments, these enriched environments that are the Goldilocks, right? Not too much, not too little, just right for our brains so that we can optimize our potential.
Yeah, I totally agree. I'm becoming a neurodiversity social justice warrior. That's like been becoming a really big part of my passion and my work because of all the things that you described. And also, you know, Ivy at Google, actually, I feel like there has been some significant strides in accommodating neurodiversity. Maybe we could talk about that a little bit. But I wondered if you could also talk about, you know, the non-linear path to getting better at these skills. So as Susan mentioned, you know, sometimes people spend a lot of time doing something they're passionate about and they still don't, quote unquote, they're not very good at it, whether, you know, whoever determines that, whether that's society valuing it or their own, you know, inner critic. But usually in my experience, those kinds of gains are not linear. They're stepwise, that you can sort of languish on a plateau for a while and then suddenly make a leap. And what seemed impossible now suddenly becomes possible. I wonder if you could speak a little bit, maybe. I mean, now I've asked you 15 different questions, so I'm just going to stop there and let you jump in with what you think is most interesting.
Well, you know, doing the art form, I think what we have to do is change people's mindset about it's not about the end product and judging what you've done. It's about the doing and understanding that the doing is doing a lot for your body and mind and soul. Whereas I think right now people give up certain practices because they haven't gotten there yet. And I agree with you. Sometimes just the patience and persistence will get you to another level. Things all of a sudden start to connect. But what we hope the book teaches people is that just that act of doing is all you need to do, and make it fun. And, you know, really the way people now exercise, I mean, if you were to pick an art form and just engage in it for 20 minutes a day, I mean, the world would be very different.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's exactly right. And I think if we can take away this pressure to be perfect, or, you know, that, yeah, art for art's sake can come back in, I think that would make also those 20 minutes more enjoyable. I think a lot of times, like, you know, people write to me and they say, oh, you know, I've been practicing the piano every day for so many years and I'm just not getting any better. And I'm like, but you're practicing the piano every day for 20 years. Like, doesn't matter if you're getting any better.
Like, right. That's doing, but if people understood that what that's doing to their brain, they would accept it more. You know, Susan and I went back and we interviewed folks from indigenous tribes, because in the past, we didn't have that word art. The arts were life. It was culture, singing, dancing, painting in caves. That just is the way life was lived. And I think we went so far from that because we started to optimize for productivity, the Industrial Revolution, and we pushed those arts, which were really wired for as a elitist practice or a nice to have. And look at where we are in society, right? Mental health is greater problem than physical health. And so I think when we explored that, it was like, wow, we need to find the happy medium here, because we took that word art and made it a commercial venture, elitist, good art, bad art. And yet we were wired to do these kinds of arts all the time.
Yeah. So, I mean, well, I think maybe we'll circle back later to the neurodiversity piece, but I wonder if we could talk a little bit about sort of the whole idea of aesthetics. So, you know, in your book, you kind of, you know, there's this term that's been bandied around, that this is the field of neuroaesthetics. And I think for, you know, for some people, aesthetics is synonymous with beauty, for others with meaning. And so I wonder if you could talk a little bit about sort of what do you mean by aesthetics and how is it that we can study it?
So it's another really great word that I think has multiple meanings for different people. But in general, I think most people think of aesthetics as style or taste. Some people think of it as beauty. But I think a very, you know, the saying beauty is in the eye of the beholder airs out with neuroaesthetics, that my beauty is not your beauty or Ivy's beauty, that based on where we come from, how we, our childhood experiences, our cultures really change, our life experiences really change what we think is beautiful. And that work was born out of some early work in the late 1990s by someone named Samir Zeki, who University College London, who started to really understand from a visual systems point of view, what we thought was beautiful was different from each other, but it was also part of the prefrontal cortex of where that was really sort of coming into shape. And we can talk about that again a little bit more too, as far as thinking about the default mode network and kind of what we each think is beautiful or what we think is meaningful, more importantly. Neuroaesthetics is a big term, but it really, the way we define it in the work that I do at Hopkins, and I think the field is now coming to understand, is that it's really bigger than beauty, bigger than beauty. And I think meaning might be a great term to add in here, but it is the study of how the arts and aesthetic experience measurably change the brain, body, and behavior. And then the second part of this is how that knowledge can be translated into specific practices that advance health and well-being. And Ivy and I call that neural arts. We've been sort of populating this term around neural arts as a field where the research is neuroaesthetics. But any way you look at it is how can the arts in this domain be in service of humanity to help us feel better? And in any way, whether that's physical health, mental health, day-to-day stress, you know, we haven't talked about flourishing, but, you know, none of us just want to cope. We want to really thrive. And how do the arts in all of their forms and aesthetic experiences help us do that? And, you know, aesthetic experiences are things like nature. You know, when you're in nature or thinking about color or scent or sound or touch, those are all aesthetic experiences. And as Ivy said earlier, in some ways, we've sort of numbed ourselves to these aesthetic mindsets, and we're very transactional, but we don't allow ourselves to bring these sensory experiences forward to really think more of a transformational kind of living.
Yeah, I think we've gone flatline a little bit, and we haven't focused on our sensory systems and how they make us feel alive, and they actually keep us alive.
Dogs are an important part of our lives. That means protecting them from parasites. Ask your vet about NexGard Plus, afoxolaner, moxidectin, and pyrantel chewable tablets. NexGard Plus chews provide one-and-done monthly protection against fleas, ticks, heartworm disease, roundworms, and hookworms. Plus, they're delicious and easy to give. Use with caution in dogs with a history of seizures or neurologic disorders. Dogs should be tested for existing heartworm infection prior to starting a preventive. Ask about NexGard Plus Chews.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's Mix and Match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Meet the next generation of podcast stars with SiriusXM's Listen Next program, presented by State Farm. As part of their mission to help voices be heard, State Farm teamed up with SiriusXM to uplift diverse and emerging creators. Tune in to Stars and Stars with Issa as host Issa Nakazawa dives into birth charts of her celeb guests. This is just the start of a new wave of podcasting. Visit statefarm.com to find out how we can help prepare for your future. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Yeah, I wonder actually if you could talk a little bit about sort of the taste and style. I mean, as Ivy, you are in a sense a taste maker, or you have been in your career. You know, your work at The Gap and at Google, even as a, you know, as a jewelry maker in the fashion world. So, can you tell us a little bit more about how you think about taste, and you know its relationship to. I think there's a social component to it, right? Like we want to feel like we have good taste and it sort of feels intuitive. And there's a kind of like the person with good taste is kind of elevated. But of course, taste changes and there's nothing worse than thinking you have good taste, but realizing that you're out of date. How do you approach this
issue?
I'm still
wearing jeans from high school, so don't say that.
Oh, but they're totally back in style. They're like, you can go and buy, you know, these like, yeah, jeans from the 80s that are like, yeah, and of course, you know.
Yeah, so. 80s was not my high school decade, but yeah.
Yeah, if you hold on to things long enough, it comes full circle. But no, you bring up a good question. Having come from the fashion industry, we were all trained to really look at societal trends and tie that back to what people might be craving at certain times as society moved through certain cycles. Even color, for example, during times when things were a little depressed, you watch and bright colors were what people were craving. So I became interested in, you know, people would say to me, how could you be in fashion? It's so frivolous. And it's not. I was an art major and psychology minor, and I was always fascinated with why people would gravitate towards certain things. And so that has always been a common thread. And I think the taste, you know, Susan and I did an experiment at Milan and Salone where we had people walk through three different rooms with different colors, scents, sound, textures, art, and with wearing a band that had sensors so that people were able to, at the end, see how their bodies were feeling in these different aesthetic environments. And the aesthetic environment that their mind thought it liked the best, over 50% of the time, was not the one their body felt most comfortable in. And that was the aha, is that we're feeling all the time and sensing things. And so people wanted to know, was that the right room? Like, what is the room that has the best taste or the best style? And from someone that has had to create things, hopefully in good style, it was great for me to say, there is no right answer. It's about what felt good to you. And so I really do believe that I love people who have their own sense of style, if it's fully who they are, if they could tap into using it as self-expression. That said, my job as a design lead is to work with my team to sense what's coming and what people might be craving emotionally or tactility-wise or color-wise, and really play into that, because what you want is, and do that with good taste, or, you know, and everyone has their own style. Mine tends to be less is more, so a little more minimal. So yes, there are threads of style that go across everything, but for example, the work at Google, we really are doing technology and electronics with soft curves, which we know people respond to better because it's something we've seen in nature, and more texture versus one material. So there are conscious things that we do as designers that, because I think designers have antennas up, and they are making these connections and sensing all the time what wants to emerge. And our job then is to create that and offer it up to the public. So,
and it's fair to say you are bringing neurobiology research and evolutionary research now into the way people think about design. You're starting to merge those worlds more.
Yes, I think that is what people are craving, is to have a reaction when they look at an object or something. And why not make it beautiful or make it desirable? Or when we do consumer research now, the designers start with, after they create a product or a form, what's the emotion that they hope a person will feel when they see the object or pick up the phone or put on the watch? What are those emotional words? And then when we bring it into focus groups, the researchers come back to us with a word cloud of what people said, and the joy and delight when what someone says when they first put on that digital watch or even pick up that phone, if it matches the designer's intent, you know, it's like, wow, it's very exciting. Because I think that's what you want to do, is you want to transmit an emotion through these objects that we design.
Yeah, I was surprised to learn that, you know, if you think about sort of design thinking, which is a type of strategy used to teach designers how to, you know, how to thrive in their jobs. And the very first element is empathy, right? Empathize with your end user so that there's this emotional component to it.
And we've actually now, we talk about design feeling instead of design thinking.
Oh,
I think
interesting.
That's the next evolution. Huh. Because design thinking is absolutely a way a designer has to think, because design is about solving problems for people. And so you have to have empathy with the person you're solving the problem for. And so that's table stakes. So the layer that we've added on now is this idea of design feeling. What do you want people to feel, as well as having solved the functional problem?
And of course, that's the whole, for many artists, the whole goal of whatever art they make is to evoke a reaction, emotion, usually. But there is this also, as you were mentioning, very subjective element of it, right? So like the designer might think that they're designing an object that will have a particular reaction. And sometimes, maybe even often, it doesn't provoke that reaction, or not for everyone. And of course, that kind of individual variability traditionally has been problematic for neuroscientists who are interested in looking and making, you know, general principles and looking at large samples of people. I wonder, Susan, if you could talk a little bit about how the neuroaesthetics approach solves the problem of individual variability and subjectivity, if it does.
So, you know, when you were talking about evoking an emotion as an artist, I think professional artists are maybe more, that's their job to evoke a certain feeling. But I think there's also self-expression, where you're putting something out and you may not be putting it out to evoke an expression from someone else, but to gain empathy and understanding. And I'm seeing that a lot now with youth mental health, where a youth are wanting to share how they feel in a safe environment and a lower risk environment. And so I think it depends on, I think of this field often as the elephant in the room, and depending where you touch it, you get something really different. If you're a professional artist, your job is to evoke emotion, maybe. If you're someone who's making, needs to share something, you're expressing, and maybe you're not trying to get someone to feel what you're feeling, you're really trying to get it out. And I think the maker and the beholder relationships are very symbiotic, but they're also different depending upon why you're making something and why you're beholding something. Your question about the individual variability, I think what researchers have done is actually say that is true. And while we know some things about the neurobiology of how the arts might work, individual difference, I think, is one of the strengths. And so to me, it's about personalization. It's about customizing. It's about creating environments that work for you and not necessarily these generalized spaces or consensus statements that are so blanket that they, you know, like Ivy mentioned, curves. We do know evolutionarily that we like curves. We like curved spaces behind us and a horizon in front of us. We like the things that are, you know, that we can cup because our hands can hold them, or, you know, we do know certain things, and I think they're interesting design principles. And there's a researcher at Hopkins that did some great work on curves versus lines, and his name is Ed Connor. And what he found was that there was a particular kind of curve that most people gravitated towards, and it turned out that it was very similar to an arc curve and the sculptor. And so I think there are some things that we know universally, but to underscore individuality is actually really important. So, and you can create individuality in lots of places and spaces. You know, this idea of intentional design, I think, is something that's going to be more and more prevalent as we start to understand how we bring the world in so differently.
Which goes along with personalized medicine, right? I think it makes perfect sense. And what we found through interviewing a lot of folks is this idea of using the arts to just personally express what's inside instead of repressing it is a big piece of why the arts work.
Yeah. And, you know, I want to lean into that a little bit in terms of the relationship with health, because I think that some of the mistakes that have been made early on in this arts and health field is this idea that, oh, you know, listening to instrumental classical music makes me feel calm, so we should just, you know, pump it through all the hospital rooms and everybody will feel calm. And of course, like, that's not true. For some people, it's quite triggering. It can make them feel alienated. So I wonder if you could speak a little bit to sort of, let's talk about some of the ways, the more recent research on the impact of arts on our health and well-being, and sort of the role that personalization plays in that.
Sure. Well, and I think you make a really, really great point when you talk about that. You know, this field is early, where we're really looking to apply the arts in health in particular. And I think there's been a lot of really great intention. And sometimes, you know, that hasn't really been proven. There's also, I think it's super important to say, is that the arts and health are not well-funded. The research is not well-funded. The practitioners are not well-funded. The architecture and design, the training is not well-funded. So we are an army of really amazing people, artists and practitioners, who I think are really doing their very best to figure out how you bring this forward with not enough resources. And so, you know, that's something that there's a lot of work around the world trying to really build this field so there are ample financial resources, there's a sustainable model to be able to build this field. But we do know some things, right? We do know that singing really helps people with dementia, and that can improve cognition and certainly quality of life. We know that dancing helps people with Parkinson's disease and stroke and other motor-related disorders, and we've seen it improve gait and cognition and sleep and mood. And just to put a spotlight on Parkinson's for a moment, the folks at Mark Morris have something called Dance for PD. And in the pandemic, and most of the time, it's all over the country and now really all over the world. But if you had Parkinson's, you would need to go to a dance studio to dance. So maybe you'd go once a week, and you'd have to get on a bus or a train or take an Uber. And it was a lot of effort to do that. The progress that people made and the sense of accomplishment was really huge. And they used multiple dances to elicit different types of movement. Community was built, really very positive. During COVID, people couldn't go to the dance studios, so they used technology, Zoom, to start to promote it online. And people started dancing, more people all over the world. They danced more often, like every day. Sometimes people would dance more than one day. Family members danced with them. And what they started to see was that this idea around dose and dosage became something they could study. So people's cognition improved dramatically, sleep improved dramatically, gait improved dramatically for longer periods of time. So now researchers are looking at the data coming out of those COVID experiences to really try to better understand what's happening with these kinds of Parkinson's-based disease and disorders that are really affecting millions of people all over the world. So that's a really interesting example. Chronic pain is another one where virtual reality is being used pretty consistently. There's a great product that's on the market called Snow World that uses cold. It uses cold. So that's a universal thing, cold. And then it also uses humor and storytelling and really sticky graphics. So the theory here is that distraction allows people to not have as much pain when bandages are being changed with burn units and in other areas, which also allows you to use less pain medication. So these are just a couple examples of some of the things that we're seeing in healthcare, but there's many more.
Yeah, I wonder, Ivy, if you could speak a little bit to this future of virtual reality. On the one hand, it opens up a whole set of interventions for people who maybe aren't as mobile, or, you know, on the other hand, it's expensive and, you know, not everyone's going to have access to VR. And also it can be isolating. And we, during the pandemic, I think recognized how powerful in-person interaction is. So where are you thinking, you know, as a design lead at Google, yeah, as an artist yourself, you know?
I view technology as here to amplify our humanity. That's the way I like to see it. And in some cases, and anything has its polar opposites, right? In terms of, it's all about how you use it. So for example, the amazing things that we were able to do now online and affect millions of people at once versus, you know, not being able to connect. And I know at Google, we're mostly all hybrid now, which is, I like to have the saying, it's not either or, it's both and. So I think that's where the answer lies, is we have to be together. And there are times when we need to be alone together in our individual environments. But I think technology is going to do some amazing, you know, we're talking about the fact that we're not going to even just look at a painting anymore. We're going to walk into it. And there's a lot of art that has already started to come forth where you have the experience of walking into the painting and that is igniting so many more senses than just looking at the painting. So I think it's really about balance. I don't want to live a life where I'm living it in the headset, but there are times, as Susan pointed out, where it's amazing to, because the brain will communicate to the body as if it's in that place. And especially in health and wellness, to be able to send signals to the brain that you are there in the cold and so don't feel the pain of the heat is phenomenal. So as long as, you know, my team and I, we always look at it as what can technology do that takes certain things off of our hands that can be done mechanically that allows us as humans to then do only what humans can do. But I also think now with some of the development, it'll actually provide new experiences for us. Like I just mentioned, walking into a painting that we haven't had the ability to do. So like everything, it's all about moderation and both and.
You know, you make me think about set and setting related to psychedelics. You know, like set and setting is really about how do you prepare someone for an experience and how do you help them move through an experience and then integrate at the back end. Psychedelics are an extraordinary tool, but there's also a downside to psychedelics, right? Same is true with technology. They're an amazing tool, and there's also cautionary tales about that. I think that's true for a lot of things. And so how do you manage risk and thinking about that? But set, in some ways, I had this hit that set and setting and aesthetics are kind of what we're talking about. How do you create these containers and this capacity with our sensorial systems and the different art forms to be able to help us move through the world? And whatever aids that is really, you know, helpful.
You know, we know that architecture, space changes the way you think. So, and I've seen this time and time again with design teams, you know, we change the building that we're in, the amount of light, the scale, the colors, and it changes the way we think as a group. So this idea of set and setting and space, even architectural space, profoundly changes our brain and body.
Yeah, I mean, everything has risks, right? Even falling in love has its pros and
yes,
its cons,
sure.
Right? So I want to remind our listeners that Susan Mac-Sammons and Ivy Ross's book, Your Brain on Art, is available at booksellers everywhere. And I wonder if you have a kind of last vision that you could share with us. Let's say we look out 10 years from now, you know, your book was a massive bestseller. Everybody's read it. Everybody's on board with this idea that the arts are important, that they can influence our health. We're starting to change our settings to make contexts that are more conducive to making art. What does the world look like then? What is the best case scenario for you?
Governments and the public sector support it, that they put enough money into the research and the practice so that people can really have vibrant careers in this area, and that there's great education and training for this work, and that we continue to think of it as a science and an art. So it gets funded the way the Brain Initiative gets funded and other things, and in this country, but all over the world. And I think the more that we can develop ongoing sensorial literacy in schools early on, we bring the arts back into schools. So we see it as Ivy said, indigenous cultures, which there are 500 plus indigenous cultures still in the world that use the arts as every day becomes part of the fabric of our lives. And I think the end result is a much more truly integrated whole humanity. And I think it's possible. I mean, I think it's really within our reach.
Well, Susan and Ivy, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts on Inquiring Minds.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So that's it for another episode. Thanks for listening. And if you want to hear more, don't forget to subscribe. If you'd like to get an ad-free version of the show, consider supporting us at patreon.com/inquiringminds. I want to especially thank our longtime supporters. We could not get to 400 without you. David Noel, Herring Chang, Sean Johnson, Jordan Miller, Kyle Royhalla, Michael Galgool, Eric Clark, Yushi Lin, Clark Lindgren, Joel, Stefan Meyer Awal, Dale Lemaster, and Charles Blyle. Inquiring Minds is produced by Adam Isaac, and I'm your host, Indre Viscontis. See you next time. There's more. There's more.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.